92.5 on your FM dial. This is the Wild Clearwater Country Show. A couple quick announcements for you. Then we'll get into some weather, which looks to be getting cooler again, Gary.
Yay!
All right. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Tonight, the 1912 building. Birds, Bats, and Blades, Wind Turbines and Protected Wildlife. Presentation by a naturalist and expert birder and co-chair of the Blue Mountain Audubon Society, Mike Denny. He will be talking about wind energy, wind turbines, their effects on wildlife, the science behind those studies, who funds the science, and a lot of really informative stuff about wind farms and wildlife. That's tonight at the 1912 building across from Moscow High School.
That'll be a great show. The Blue Mountains and the Columbia Gorge out there, Snake River, Plains Country, a lot of turbines. So I think that's a very germane issue.
And this is a monthly meeting of the Palouse Audubon Society. You can find them there having their monthly presentations at the 1912 building. Another announcement, the Palouse Land Trust is having their annual meeting at the 1912 building this Friday. They will have good food and wine, as well as the music of Potato Head. That's this Friday, December 15th, 7 p.m. at the 1912 building. Palouse Land Trust works to protect private land in the Palouse.
And yes, they're our local land trust, and I believe they were involved in the project to help protect the Cedars, along with a lot of other organizations up on Moscow Mountain. And I believe they are also involved with the small cedar grove down there at Idler's Rest.
That's right. That's right. They manage the Idler's Rest Grove and some property up on the St. Joe and St. Mary's here in the near future.
Yeah. Here we go. Well, Will, I had an announcement. This is more of a news item. So should we go to a break and come back to do news items?
Yeah, let me kick off the weather. We'll go to a musical break, and we'll be back with some current news.
All right.
Your weather out there at the Moscow Pullman Regional Airport, it's 44 degrees. It's pretty darn warm right now, but it's going to be cooling. Low of 35 tonight. Looks like there's a chance of rain and snow this evening. And going into tomorrow, it's going to be a high of 41, more rain or snow mix possible. And into the weekend, your lows are going to be down in the high 20s, low 20s getting into Saturday night and Sunday, and a medium chance of snow for those days. And into the Sunday, looking to be actually lows in the teens.
Yes.
All right. That's the kind of weather we like.
Some real weather. Some real winter weather.
We'll be right back.
We got homeless on the street. and the food's not safe to eat. Treat your world with disrespect. Don't think there ain't no pain to do. A clear cut case of the blues. Cupcakes.
of the blues. Where we live now is a clear-cut case of the
clear-cut case of the blues.
Ah, yeah, Mr. Bader.
Mike Bader.
Good little environmental message there in that old blues tune.
Yeah. Well, let's get into the news. News roundup, wrap-up, whatever you call it. Gary?
Yeah.
Lots in the news here this past week.
Well, let's start off with what the Forest Service just said recently, and then we'll do a little wrap-up of The lame
wah, duck.
There we go. The lame duck Congress. All right, let's start it off with the Forest Service.
Yes.
They announced today, in fact, they have produced what is called in political parlance or policy parlance, a rule. And this rule exempts forest plans from going through an environmental impact statement or even an environmental assessment. Rather, they are categorically excluded from the National Environmental Policy Act. Now, some people might be wondering, haven't I heard on this show before that they did that back in 2005? Oh, yes, they did. But this is merely sort of some housekeeping or house cleaning measures. The Forest Service came out with their new rule, other rule, about how to conduct forest plans and how to do them. But there's another category of rules the Forest Service has on what can and can't be exempted from analysis under the National Environmental Policy Act. And so today they changed that rule and came up with the idea that forest plans don't have to go through that process, even though they decided that back in 2005. They formally put forest plans in that exempt category. There are a few other things like, and some things are fairly obvious. It's okay, you know, like mowing the lawn at the ranger station or painting the one of the outhouses out in the back, you know, at a campground, backcountry campground or something. But an entire forest plan?
Yeah, that's absurd.
It is. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later on the show, Will.
We sure will.
But today they came up with a formal putting that into this other category, even though they had decided well over a year ago that forest plans would be exempt in their rules determining how to do forest plans. This is just, they sort of had to make a change in two places rather than one in their set of regulations, and this was doing the second change. A little mere formality, mm-hmm. But we'll talk a little bit about that later as well, some things that may be happening there a little bit later in the show. But just people should know there is a lawsuit challenging that 2005 rule change, and I suspect it may be successful.
Let's talk about the waterfowl. Let's talk about the lame ducks, Gary.
Well, interesting Congress. Looks like there isn't a budget bill that passed. They have a, quote, continuing resolution, as I understand it. There were a bunch of things that tried to get tacked on at the very end, some so-called wilderness legislation. And you probably heard on the show before, close to 90 grassroots organizations across the country sent a letter several months ago to the conservation community as a whole, and also Congress, saying now is not the time to pass wilderness legislation if it's not clean, and especially if we're making trade-offs in it. There's been a very disturbing trend to get something, quote, declared as wilderness, because only Congress does that, by trading away the very foundation on which wilderness rests. That's public lands, giving away public lands. There's been kind of an ugly trend in a few bills lately. And That doesn't lead to overall protection, and many people argue that these new bills actually provide less protection for the land as a whole than the status quo. And I think that's true. Well, Congress looked at several of those type of wilderness bills. It passed actually a good wilderness bill in Vermont, which was clean, real wilderness bill, and that happened just before the end of the lame duck, mm-hmm. as I recall. It wasn't the last minute effort. In fact, it was something that had been agreed to for some time, and so that passed. But in all the tax bills and budget resolution, what it was actually continuing the resolution to continue funding Congress at the and the government at the current rate, I guess, and dumping on the new Congress the entire process of having to deal with the budget for this year, even though it should have been done back in October. The do-nothing Congress decided to
do nothing
and dump it on the next Congress. So that happened. But some of the bills that did pass, there's a little vehicle called a rider where somebody tries to attach something completely unrelated to it. And here in Idaho, we have two of these pseudo wilderness bills sort of being kicked around. One is the Central Idaho Economic Development Recreation Act, and the development economic development part of that bill is very prominent. We designate some wilderness down in the Boulder White Clouds, although it has some amendments to the Wilderness Act, right, in the legislation that makes that area a little bit weaker. It grants rights. It would make it hard to manage horseshoes, including outfitting horseshoes in the wilderness, and gives them special rights that hikers don't have, which is kind of odd. And it does a few other things that aren't so good, but would designate some wilderness, but in exchange for giving away public land and also changing the rules under which off-road vehicles are managed, a big chunk of the land, it would make off-road vehicle use a dominant part of the landscape rather than going to the normal process that the Forest Service and or BLM have under their what are called the executive orders, and allowing it only where it doesn't cause undue damage and there's this is a very important and, where it doesn't conflict with other existing recreation uses. So that was a couple of the bad provisions in that bill. Congressman Simpson from that district of Idaho down there tried to tack that onto one of these existing bills. He wasn't successful, thankfully. That didn't pass. But there's been a lot of media spin lately saying, it really should have passed, even though the Senate's never held a hearing on that bill. And at least on the full Senate floor, I think they may have talked a little bit in Craig's committee on the Senate, actually heard the bill, but didn't. Actually, it's never gone to the floor. They haven't had a committee vote, I should say.
They were trying to tack that on last minute, Cedra.
Yeah, they did.
And Larry Craig, who had voiced opposition
before, yeah,
withdrew his opposition right before it yeah. failed to pass.
Failed to pass. They weren't able to tack it on.
So
that didn't happen. They also tried to, there was an effort to try to do that with the Owyhee Initiative. Now, that bill hasn't gone through any floor action. Cedra did pass the U.S. House. Although it couldn't pass on its own, it got lumped together with a lot of other bills. It was a lot of people, including the new chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee, Nick Rahal, expressed opposition to Cedra because of some of these bad provisions. Anyway, the Owyhee bill did not pass through the committee as it didn't happen in the Senate for Cedra. So before an action, you really should come to the floor. It usually goes through the committee. So they tried to circumvent that with Cedra. Like I said, it had passed the House. And the Owyhee bill, well, neither passed, which was a rather good thing. Same thing tried to happen in Washington County with a bill, another bad bill. And Washington County is in Utah, southwestern Utah. That didn't happen. Unfortunately, though, a Democrat was able to tack a bill that's just like the Washington County bill, almost a mirror image in White Pine County. In fact, some ways it's far worse, onto the package that did pass. And although it did designate some wilderness, it has a lot of the weakening amendments that have been unfortunately crept into the Wilderness Act. The Wilderness Act was a compromise back in 1964. Now it's continually being redefined, the bar lowered and lowered, and that's eventually it'll be meaningless if that continues. It happens in this bill a little bit, but it also, the other problem with this was the huge land sales, 45,000 acres of land now. The BLM identified about half that acreage as possible for land sales and disposal because they're isolated, but it ordered the BLM to go back and change your plan to make it look like it was consistent with the plan and sell and identify another 23,000 acres of land that had to be sold. And so it's now on the auctioning block. And some other bad provisions. One, I don't know if this bad provision passed, which required or promoted a large landscape conversion from pinyon juniper to basically grass. And if it's anything like what normally happens, it would be an exotic grass, crested wheatgrass, a cultivar planted mainly for livestock forage, converting of native vegetation to exotic vegetation out there on public lands. Not a very good idea. And I'm not sure if that provision got through, Will. But that's what happened in the lame duck. I think because of opposition of those organizations and grassroots conservation groups and others that we didn't see all those bills passing, all four of the bad four, as it was called. So that's sort of what happened in the lame duck at the very end. Harry Reid is, unfortunately, he was able to get the White Pine bill through. And I don't know what that bodes for the future of some of this legislation. He will now become the Senate Majority Leader in the new Congress, and his record on conservation issues is good outside the state of Nevada, but in Nevada he's been known for some shady land dealings and whatnot, and there has been an expose on him, I believe was written by the Los Angeles Times a couple years ago, about some of the land deals / influence peddling. So there's some definitely questionable from an ethical standpoint. I don't know if there's any legal problems, but some people have questioned the actual ethics of what happens there. And so there's a concern. So that's what happened.
All right.
Even in spite of the fact he has a D by his name. And of course, Will, since we've been talking about Congress, I'm going to throw in our usual disclaimer. These views don't represent those of any organization or KRFP Moscow.
And we're going to come back after a musical break. We're going to be looking at and talking about some myths of the backcountry. You've heard of urban legends. Well, we're going to tackle a couple wildland legends and expose some truth behind some of the misinformation out there. And as usual, we will have the peak of the week and also the Whopper of the
Week. Whopper of the Week, that's right.
Stay with us.
Never hit 17 when you play against the dealer, for you know that the odds won't ride with you. And never leave your woman alone when your friends are out to steal her. Years are gambled and lost like summer wages. And we'll keep a rolling on till we get to Vancouver, and the woman that I love is living there. It's been 6 long months and more since I've seen her. She may be gambled and gone like summer wages. And all the beer taverns all down along Young Street, the dreams of the seasons are all spilled down on the floor. All the big stands of timber just waiting for falling, and the hustlers sitting watchfully as they wait there by the door. So I'll work on them towboats in my slippery city shoes, which I swore I would never do again. Through the gray fog-bound straits where the cedars stand watching, I'll be far off and gone like summer wages. A woman so fine, I may never try to find her, for good memories are what we had before. They should never be changed, for they're all that I'll take with me. Now I've gambled and lost my summer wages.
You're listening to KRFP 92.5 FM dial, Radio Free Moscow. All right, that's J.D. Crow in the New South. Well, we are welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country. We're going to tackle a few of the backcountry myths out there, wildland legends, and I guess as a big umbrella, this one falls under the umbrella of forest health.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear a lot about certain activities
happen. What a great bad message. Forest health.
Mm-hmm.
As if trees, if it's a forest that has trees that are dying or unhealthy. You know, every population has things that die. In fact, part of the natural process, trying to eliminate agents of disease in a forest, may not be such a good idea. For example, those insects provide food for other critters.
That's right. That's right. All other healthy populations have dying members, and to say that a forest is unhealthy because of the condition of the trees, the health is definitely not dependent upon the health of an individual or even a stand of trees per se. And forest health is actually just a euphemism for tree health, one that the Bush administration has pushed pretty hard over the last several years with the Healthy Forest Restoration Act, trying to healthen up our very unhealthy western forests. And I've convinced a lot of the public that our forests aren't healthy, and that because they aren't healthy, we need to do something about them, because these threats, actually, these unhealthy forests do pose threats to us as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And so under that forest health umbrella, and just first to finish dispelling the myth that the trees are the only component of a forest, first of all, trees are just a small portion of a forest's biomass and biodiversity. Grasses, liverworts, salamanders, springtails, elk, spawning salmon, streams, soil, rocks, and much, much more make up a forest. And a healthy forest is a diverse forest. And a healthy forest also has natural processes that play out, including wildfire and other catastrophic natural events such as flooding. But in the West, flooding and wildfire are two of the most important that shape the landscape in a forest. Which leads me into the myth this week. The wildland legend is that salvage logging can be healthy for an ecosystem. In fact, salvage logging is one of the most damaging forest management practices that occurs on our public lands, and it actually dramatically impedes post-fire ecosystem recovery.
Okay, so salvaging after fire.
Supposedly salvaging those dead trees for the timber we can get out of them.
Instead of having them rot. Go to waste.
We don't want those trees to go to waste.
That's right. Okay.
So if you think back, a couple of notable fires have allowed scientists to study salvage logging to a pretty thorough extent. The Biscuit Fire, several years back in Oregon.
The southwest part of Oregon,
and
yeah.
This most recent fire seasons, or I guess it was 2005 fire season, School Fire
down in the Umatilla Forest, not far from here.
Not far from here at all. And scientists have been out there studying these fires and studying the effects that salvage logging has on an area versus how an area regenerates naturally. And a couple of amazing facts and data were collected. Researcher out of Oregon State University, Donato, and which this paper came out in January 2006, issue of Science, mm-hmm. a peer-reviewed journal, pretty well-known one. Post-wildfire logging hinders regeneration and increases fire risk. Donato, in studying the Biscuit Fire, actually found out that natural conifer regeneration can be reduced by 2/3 following a salvage logging event. That is an area that they looked at mostly Doug fir forests and counted the number of seedlings that regenerated following a fire and the number of seedlings that regenerated following a post-fire logging operation. And the number that sprouted up following the fire without any management, 767 seedlings per hectare, compared to 224 seedlings per hectare for those areas that were salvage logged. And that's due to a lot of things. Soil compaction mainly, though. Mm-hmm. That logging activity, and you have to remember the logging isn't so much the problem as it is the machinery and the damage the machinery does to the ground where the logging takes place. A lot of the damage that is caused in salvage logging is soil damage. The soil is either compacted, it's continued to erode. It can be stirred up to a point that a lot of the native flora and the biodiversity in the soil can be killed, damaged, or the main composition of the soil decomposers can be altered, which can have a huge impact on the type of forest that returns to that area following the fire and the logging. Another interesting fact here. So, one, natural regeneration of plants and trees can be severely reduced following salvage logging. And another very important point that Donato revealed here in their paper is that the amount of woody fuel debris on the ground can be increased dramatically after salvage logging. So you can actually increase the chance of catastrophic wildfire
returning to the area.
Returning to the area following a salvage logging event. Pretty good paper that he did. Another really great source of information on salvage logging is out of Oregon State also, Robert Betcha. And they did a position paper, Wildfire and Salvage Logging, came out in 1995.
They also had an update to that, I believe, in 2000-something as well.
That's right. And they talk about a lot of the principles of soil regeneration, and how damaging these salvage logging practices can be on the forest. And just to underscore the importance of soil, I think most folks don't have a real good concept of soil. In range ecosystems, up to 90% of the biodiversity is found beneath the ground. And a majority of the productivity happens beneath the ground as well. And just to mention a few of the organisms found down there in the depth beneath those trees, those unhealthy trees, many bacteria, autotrophic bacteria, which do photosynthesize and return nutrients to the soil in that way, decomposing bacteria, actinomycetes, very important type of bacteria that break down cellulose, which is plant fiber, and chitin, which is found in fungus and in insect exoskeletons. Protozoans. Thousands of protozoans are found in a pinch of soil, and if you don't remember those protozoans, they are those tiny little critters that you see under the microscope that have cilia or flagella and have locomotor motion using those type of devices. They eat bacteria and provide food for nematodes and for microarthropods. You have plenty of nematodes, which are very, very small roundworms, millions of nematodes per cubic foot of soil, and they do a great job of dispersing organic matter and decomposers. Another crucial part of the soil are the fungi, the mycorrhizal fungi, which actually work with tree roots to help trees absorb nutrients, and some trees are obligatory. They have to have these mycorrhizal fungi or they cannot survive. Their uptake of water and nutrients won't happen unless these fungus are present as well. And there are plenty of arthropods too, which we're all familiar with, insects, arachnids, crustaceans such as springtails, centipedes, and millipedes. And all those guys churn soil. They aerate the soil, they shred organic matter, they regulate protozoans and nematodes, and they also provide food for burrowing mammals, insects, and lizards. So all this biodiversity in life is found in those soils which are so easily damaged by practices such as salvage logging. Soil itself is an incredibly diverse, you can't really call it an organism, but suite of organisms. And the National Cooperative Soil Survey has identified and mapped over 20,000 types of soils. And so soil itself is unique, and disrupting those unique soils could damage a lot of the flora and fauna that depended on that very specific type of soil. The last part I want to go into here on salvage logging, the myth of salvage logging, is talking about from the ground up, the importance of dead trees, the importance of that structural diversity, vertical structural diversity, diversity of coarse woody debris that's found. A lot of studies show that a dead tree is more valuable for wildlife than a live tree. Dozens of bird species use trees for snags, as perches for their nest sites, and also to find food. And most specifically, for severely burned areas, the blackback woodpecker really keys in on these severe burns and needs these areas to find its food source, which are often emerging beetle larvae from these dead snags. This structural diversity also provides some soil stability. The leaf litter and the intact tree roots provide soil stability, preventing erosion and preventing excess soil heating. And they can also provide home for the herps and forest inverts, roosts for the ground birds, and also beds for ungulates and dens for a lot of different mammal species.
So your lizards and amphibians, commonly called herps, are for herpetology, and the invertebrates. Okay.
That's right. So salvage logging really has a detrimental effect, and if it's done, if you see a project proposal and it's being done in the name of forest health, you can be sure that they're trying to hide the real reason for this project. Mm-hmm. Salvage logging is done to benefit the timber industry so they can get some logs to the mill and make a few dollars. And it's seldom, if ever, beneficial for an ecosystem. Helicopter and cable logging may have a smaller impact on the soil, but the cost and the use of petroleum doesn't really justify those practices either.
Well, there we go, Will. That's a great little update. So we found out that those trees, far from being wasted, those burnt trunks and branches that we see after a big, large fire, contribute not only wildlife habitat when they're above ground, but once they fall down, they contribute to the formation of soil. And I believe there's also been some studies that show that even if a tree trunk's badly burned, a lot of that charcoal gets into the soil and acts almost like a sponge. It's part of the hydrologic, long-term hydrologic function of a watershed. Wow.
Yeah.
There we go. Well, should we shift gears here just a little bit? Now we've got the urban legends or the wildland legends, I guess we call them backcountry legends. Address some of those. I think we got to keep doing this, you know, having that. We got a few recurring themes here on the show and standard programs. And we're going to go into another one right now. The peak.
The peak of the week.
Of the week.
All right.
Well, this week's peak is kind of one of the craggier ones that we see in the wild Clearwater country. And it's entirely within the Clearwater region. Some of the peaks we've talked about actually border the Clearwater country, and even a couple of them been just south of the border, so to speak, still within what we call our wild Clearwater region. But this one is entirely within the Clearwater drainage itself. And this peak is in an area where three interesting watersheds begin, all part of the Clearwater. One of them is Kelly Creek. The other is Cayuse Creek. And the third one is the Locksaw itself, but actually one of the side streams. Let's start from the Locksaw. This mountain in some of the older maps is listed as being 7,705 feet, at least on one map. Some of the newer maps list it just a little bit under that, 7,660 feet. It's, as I say, there's some crags up in there. There's some mountain goats that live on this thing. There's a big lake bearing the same name at the base of it. And it's called Williams Peak. Mm. So Williams Peak is within the Kelly Creek, or some people call it the Great Burn on the other side of the hill there in Montana. They call it the Great Burn roadless area. One of our large, nearly a third of a million acres, between a quarter and a third of a million acres in size, one of the great potential wildernesses. And as I said, it's Williams Peak itself is sort of there at the headwaters of Cayuse, some of the forks of Kelly Creek. In fact, there's Williams Creek that runs into the South Fork of Kelly Creek up there on the headwaters. And also one of the headwaters of a Boulder Creek, one of the side streams there, comes from a Williams Lake, which is right there sort of at the base of Williams Peak. Big mountain, wild mountain kind of a, and some of the peaks around it, you go to Kelly's Finger, some of the others are some of the more jagged in that part of the northern end of the Bitterroot. They're north of Highway 12. The Bitterroot range sort of drops down, isn't as high. And generally, it doesn't seem to be as dramatic. But here, Williams Peak and some of the surrounding its subsidiary ridges and peaks are quite jagged, rocky, craggy, some of that really typical alpine spectacular country that we associate with the Mountain West. And the other reason I chose Williams Peak is just a very quick personal story, Will. The most frightened I've ever been by lightning was right near Williams Peak. We had our tent set up, and we thought it was in a pretty good place. It was away from any high, tall standing trees. But we had this thunderstorm come through, and there was no time when this lightning bolt, you saw the flash of light. At the same time, you heard this loud boom. It was just right on top of us, and some of the trees near us were zapped. Oh, boy, it was a frightening experience right there up on Williams Peak. So if you're ever up there, watch for the clouds. That's all I have to say about Williams Peak. Spectacular area inside the Kelly Creek roadless country. Like I say, headwaters of Boulder Creek, which flows into Locksaw. Eventually, after it joins, I believe it's Crooked Fork. So, make sure I'm right on that. Well, I get Crooked and Brushy Fork sort of mixed up some from time to time, but I believe it is. Yeah, it is Crooked Fork. One of the only unroaded portions of Crooked Fork are up there in the headwaters of Williams Peak.
All right. Well, we're going to get into a little bit more music here.
All right,
and we're going to be right back. And stay tuned for the Whopper of the Week.
That's right.
Welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country.
Well, it's that time. A little bit of pounding, a little bit of drumming for the Whopper of the Week. And if you listen to the program, I think you have a pretty good guess.
Oh,
at
yeah.
What entity gets the Whopper of the Week for
man.
Saying? And going through the second rule change to state that forest plans, these big plans that give direction to the Forest Service, do not need to go through environmental analysis under the National Environmental Policy Act.
Ridiculous.
That's ridiculous. Very deserving. Very deserving. And perhaps a very short-lived regulation, Will.
Yeah, these CEs were designed, like Gary mentioned earlier, to so that common tasks like mowing the grass out back don't have to go through an EIS. That makes sense.
And now they're using it for things like logging and a bunch of other projects. And under this current administration regime, I think probably a better word for it.
Regime.
Under the current regime, they're trying to get away with Moida, as the great Groucho Marx would have said. Moida.
Forest Service.
All right, yes.
There you go.
There you
go. Another whopper for you.
A little whopper of the week.